Okay, I'm not ready to say a whole lot about Malachi, but we're going to start our reading of him and his prophecy. Malachi, the name means my messenger or my angel, if you want to use that term. My messenger, which is what an angel is. Malachi is a very difficult prophecy to date precisely compared to most of the prophets, which can be dated rather precisely. He doesn't give us any indication of when he wrote, except that the second temple is already built. It's already been in use for at least some decades, and you pick that up from the context of the book. So Zechariah and Haggai and Zerubbabel are certainly in the past. Ezra and Nehemiah seem to be in the past, but with some statements, especially in Malachi chapter 2, it seems that the conditions in Judea are very much like the conditions under the corrupted priesthood that Ezra had to replace. So either Malachi's writing during that time or, but not saying anything about Ezra, which is unlikely, or just after the time of Ezra, where the priesthood became corrupted once again, which I think is more likely. So I would date Malachi to somewhere between the end of the 5th and the middle of the 4th century BC, but that's just an estimate from what we know from the circumstances in Malachi. It's difficult to pin down precisely. He definitely did not write long before the middle of the 5th century BC, and he couldn't have written after the end of the 4th century BC without being in the Hellenistic period. And Malachi's writing does not reflect the Hellenistic period at all from the time of Alexander the Great, not at all. He's definitely writing in the Persian period. So it's probably sometime in the very late 5th or early 4th century BC, in my opinion. And I can't date him any better than that. The priesthood is becoming corrupted once again, as it was corrupted in the time of Nehemiah and again in the time of Ezra. And both of those prophets had to make amends and chastise the people and straighten things out. And it seems to be a recurring problem at this time in the history of Jerusalem that they just couldn't keep themselves straight. So Malachi is also a prophecy of the Edom and the Edomite encroachment on Judea. If we read Ezekiel chapter 35, Ezekiel prophesied 200 years at least before Malachi. Ezekiel prophesied that Edom was going to take the land of Israel and Judah to themselves after the captivities of Israel and Judah, which happened. And we could see that that happened from the time of Flavius Josephus. So in the first century, and we could see it in the New Testament, in the writings of Paul of Tarsus. So Malachi, a lot of the prophecy in Malachi deals with that issue specifically, especially in the first couple of chapters. And we'll see a lot of that this evening. That's all I have to say about Malachi.
The burden of the word of Yahweh to Israel by Malachi. I have loved you, saith Yahweh. Yet you say, wherein have you loved us? Was not Esau Jacob's brother, saith Yahweh? Yet I loved Jacob, and I hated Esau, and laid his mountains and his heritage waste for the dragons of the wilderness. Whereas Edom saith, we are impoverished, but we will return and build the desolate places. Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, they shall build, but I will throw down. And they shall call them the border of wickedness, and the people against whom Yahweh has indignation forever. And your eyes shall see, and you shall say, Yahweh will be magnified from the border of Israel. A son honors his father, and a servant his master. If then I be a father, where is my honor? And if I be a master, where is my fear? Saith Yahweh of hosts unto you, O priests, that despise my name. And you say, wherein have we despised your name? You offer polluted bread upon mine altar. And you say, wherein have we polluted thee? In that you say, the table of Yahweh is contemptible. And if you offer the blind for sacrifice, is it not evil? And if you offer the lame and sick, is it not evil? Offer it now unto thy governor. Will he be pleased with thee or accept thy person? Saith Yahweh of hosts. And now I pray you, beseech God that he will be gracious unto us. This has been by your means. Will he regard your persons? Saith Yahweh of hosts. Who is there, even among you, that would shut the doors for naught? Neither do you kindle fire on my altar for naught. I have no pleasure in you, saith Yahweh of hosts. Neither will I accept an offering at your hand. For from the rising of the sun, even unto the going down of the same, my name shall be great among the nations. And in every place, incense shall be offered unto my name, and a pure offering, for my name shall be great among the nations, saith Yahweh of hosts. But you have profaned it, in that you say, the table of Yahweh is polluted, and the fruit thereof, even his meat, is contemptible. You said also, behold, what a weariness is it! And you have snuffed at it, saith Yahweh of hosts, and you brought that which was torn, and the lame and the sick, thus you brought an offering. Should I accept this of your hand, saith Yahweh. But cursed be the deceiver, which has in his flock a male, and vows, and sacrifices unto the Lord a corrupt thing. For I am a great king, saith Yahweh of hosts, and my name is dreadful among the nations.
Here we have a prophecy that seems to be also, because much of Malachi is concerned with a far vision, it seems to have two fulfillments, a near vision and a far film, a far vision, and the as many of the other prophets do, as many of the other prophecies in the books of the prophets do. Well, this concern of Jacob for Esau, Yahweh's telling Israel, I have loved you, yet ye say, and this is a dialogue between Yahweh and Israel. It's a dialogue that's being represented here that you can't really see that well in the King James Version because there's no quotation marks and things like that. You really have to pay attention to who's speaking to who. Yet ye say is words that Yahweh is accusing the children of Israel of having said, wherein hast thou loved us, was not Esau Jacob's brother? So children of Israel are depicted here as having more concern for Esau than for themselves. So Yahweh says, yet I loved Jacob and I hated Esau and laid his mountains and his heritage waste for the dragons of the wilderness. So the Edomites all moved up out of Edomia into the lands of Judah and Israel, and they did that sometime after the Babylonian captivity, sometime after Jerusalem was destroyed in 585 BC. There's scriptures that inform us, and it's in 1 Esdras chapter 4, but it's also in the Psalms, in the 137th Psalm, remember, O Yahweh, the children of Edom in the day of Jerusalem, who said, raise it, even to the foundations thereof. So we have a picture in that Psalm, and that's the Psalm of Asaph. It was written by Asaph. He was a prophet of the captivity. He wrote this song, Psalm, if we read verse 1, he wrote it in captivity. by the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down, yeah, we wept when we remembered Zion. So he wrote this in Babylonian captivity after the destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonians. And the Edomites were in league with the Babylonians at the destruction of Jerusalem, and they were among the foremost people who were responsible for raising, for destroying the temple of Yahweh in Jerusalem. And that is actually supported in 1 Ezra chapter 4, which is actually an apocryphal version of the book of Ezra. It's actually a more complete version of the book of Ezra than we have in the book of Ezra. And it has a lot of information that's missing from the book of Ezra. Well, that being said, now these Edomites live in the land, and they're living all around the people that returned with Zerubbabel, the Israelites, the Judahites that returned with Zerubbabel. And here these Israelites are seen as having more concern for the Edomites than they do for themselves. And Yahweh's telling them that he hated Esau. And they seem incredulous at that. And we have this situation being described at this time when from the middle of the second century BC, the Israelites started forcibly converting the Edomites to Judaism. Forcibly converting them. And we'll get to that momentarily if we want to go there. I mean, we probably should. We're here. But the same situation exists today. The same situation exists today where all of these Christians who are the descendants of Israel, whether they know it or not, it doesn't matter. But they're showing more concern for Esau, these Edomite Jews in Palestine, than they have for themselves.
And this is likely being exaggerated these past couple weeks because of the whole Hamas crap, too.
Yes, but the Hamas thing makes it perfectly manifest.
Yeah. And the first temple wasn't the only temple the Edomites destroyed.
Well, no, they were the catalyst for the destruction of the second temple as well. Or I should say the third temple, Herod's temple.
But even Christ, Herod, I'm speaking more of Christ.
I also feel at the time that at verse...
Go ahead, Joe.
I was alluding more to Christ.
Well, yeah, of course. Of course.
Where it says here, Yahweh will be magnified from the border of Israel. That's very foreboding for them.
Yes, yeah. That's definitely a messianic prophecy.
And a good cross-reference for that would be Isaiah 63, where he's covered in their blood.
Joe's having a hard time.
Where it says that Yahweh gave Esau's heritage to the dragons and his nations to the dragons, that pretty much confirms that his children are mixed of the fallen angels right here.
Well, absolutely. And they're all fallen. He had no legitimate children. I mean, he may have had a generation or two of legitimate children with his wife, with Ishmael's daughter, maybe one generation of legitimate children. But when I get to my Genesis commentary, and I'm going to speak about this at length, you look at Genesis chapter 36 and Esau's descendants, he moved to Mount Horus, which was a haven of Horites, who were the Hurrians of archaeology. They were a Canaanite tribe. And he mixed with them to the degree that they're actually incorporated into his genealogy. Hurrians are incorporated into Esau's genealogy in Genesis chapter 36.
I really hope you mentioned the fact that he has a wife named Judith.
Yeah.
I really hope you meant, because that's not a coincidence. That's Yahweh putting a little something in there for us.
Yeah. Yeah, Judea was Esau's bitch. I understand.
As a side note, Armenians, they call Jews Huria to this day. And Armenians are known to have almost the same language they have had for over 3,000 years. Like, if you look at a Webster's dictionary, there'll be like a bunch of, they'll separate it into like Indo-European languages and so forth. But the Armenian one goes as one single line back 3,500 years, and they call them Huria. And Armenians are actually Hurrians themselves because they mix with Jews, right? But in their language, that's what they call them, Huria. Wanted to mention that.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. I didn't know that.
Well, does this touch a little bit with verse 2 of this chapter, with verse 10 of the next chapter, which should be referenced with John 8:41, as far as...
Well, right. It's a parallelism, yes. It's definitely a parallelism.
And right here in verse 6, Yahweh is saying he's the father of Jacob. He's the father of Israel.
So just to get this on a recording, it's long after the time of Malachi, but this is a prophecy, right? I mean, Malachi is a prophet.
Well, is the prophet of... I'm sorry, go ahead.
A lot of Christian identity people, I've heard them make this mistake quite a bit, say that the subsumption, the forced conversions of the Edomites to Judaism is recorded in the book of Maccabees, but it's not. It's not at all. And that's a mistake that a lot of Christian identity people make that listen to a Compere or a Swift or whatever, or somebody else, maybe not them, but maybe some other old timer that had it wrong. There's nothing about the forced conversion of the Edomites in the book of Maccabees. In the book of Maccabees, if you actually read it, the policy of the Maccabees was to drive the Edomites out of the cities and burn the cities. But they couldn't inhabit them for themselves because they didn't have enough people. Judea wasn't populous enough. They were very successful militarily, but they didn't have a population where they could inhabit a lot of cities. So they would leave the cities empty, and the Edomites would move right back in and start rebuilding. So this John Hyrcanus came to the high priesthood in about 129 BC. And he is the last high priest mentioned by the book of Maccabees. But the book of first book of Maccabees, second book of Maccabees, they both end when he becomes a high priest. It's over with. It's like maybe there were more chapters there and some Jew just ripped those chapters up because they didn't like them, because it would have told this account of these conversions, but it doesn't. It's lost. If it weren't for Flavius Josephus, we wouldn't have the details. But we also see the details are true from Strabo of Cappadocia, who was a Greek writer. So Josephus explains in his 13th book, and I'll quote, that Hyrcanus took also Dora and Marissa, cities of Edomia. Well, at that time, they were Edomia. But in ancient Israel, Dor was a city of the land of Manasseh, and Marissa was Marishah. That was a city in Judah. So it shows that Edomites moved into those cities, and now Josephus is counting those cities as part of Edomia, when they should have been part of Israel and Judah. So Hyrcanus took Dora, also Dora and Marissa, cities of Edomia, and subdued all the Edomians and permitted them to stay in that country if they would submit to circumcision and make use of the laws of the Judeans. And that's not all. This policy continued from the time of Hyrcanus to the time of Alexander Janius. And Alexander Janius ruled as the high priest if I'm not mistaken, probably from about 105 or 110 BC, so that's about 15, 20 years after Hyrcanus started this policy, and he ruled until about 78 BC for a long time, and he undertook that policy his whole reign. And by 78 BC, now we're getting close to the time of the Roman conquest of Jerusalem around 63 BC. And Josephus wrote of Alexander Janneus, who was the first high priest to call himself a king, by the way. But Alexander marched again to the city of Dios and took it, and then made an expedition against Essa, where was the best part of Zeno's treasures. And there he surrounded the place with three walls. And when he had taken the city by fighting, he marched to Golan and Seleucia. These are all cities on the coast of Israel. And when he had taken these cities, he, besides them, took that city which is called the Valley of Antiochus, and also the fortress of Gamala. He also accused Demetrius, who was governor of those places, of many crimes, and turned him out. And after he had spent 3 years in this war, he returned to his own country, when the Judeans joyfully received him upon his good success. So Alexander Janneus was reconquering all of the rest of the land of Israel for the people of Jerusalem. But he was converting the inhabitants to Judaism forcibly, just like Hyrcanus had started. And we'll get to that part shortly, because it's only mentioned in passing here, as if Josephus took it for granted. So he said, now at this time, the Judeans were in possession of the following cities that had belonged to the Syrians, the Idumeans, and Phoenicians. Now, when Josephus says Phoenicians, he's talking about perhaps remnant Israelites mixed with Canaanites on the seacoast. Stratos Tower, Apollonia, Joppa, which is in Gaza, near Gaza, Jamnia, Ashdod, Gaza, Antidon, Raphia, and Rhino-Kalura, in the middle of the country near to Idumea, Adorn and Marissa, near the country of Samaria, Mount Carmel and Mount Tabor, Scythopolis and Gadara, and the country of Golanitis, Seleucia and Gabala, in the country of Moab, Heshbon and Medaba, Lemba and Aronus, Gelathon, Zara, the valley of the Kalikes, and Pella, which they last utterly destroyed. Now, here's where we know everything that was going on when Alexander did all this, which was last utterly destroyed because its inhabitants would not bear to change their religious titles, their religious rites, I'm sorry, for those peculiar to the Judeans. So there we have it. In his description of Pella, you see that all these other places must have been converted to Judaism by Alexander Janneus. All these Canaanites and Edomites and other people were converted to Judaism by Alexander Janneus. That was the policy that was started by Hyrcanus. So that was when Judah was becoming, I guess, Esau's Judith, right, Noble? Esau's bitch.
Yeah.
And that was when Judah, as it's going to be described in Malachi chapter 2, Judah had a Canaanite wife, and some of his descendants are probably still in Palestine among these people. And he married the daughter of a strange god. And that is also a type for what happened to Judea in this second century BC and the beginning of the first century BC. The Judeans married the daughter of a strange god. They merged themselves with the Edomites. Strabo the geographer, he's a Greek that has no axe to grind whatsoever. And he mentioned this a few times in book 16 of his geography. He said that in book 16, in chapter 2, some writers divide Syria as a whole into Coele Syrians and Syrians and Phoenicians. Kol Assyria is the hollow Syria, it actually means. It's the place on the other side of the mountain ranges going out to Babylon. It's a broad, flat plain, practically. And Syrians would be a little further north near Damascus, and the Phoenicians would be on the coast. And say that four other tribes are mixed up with these, namely Judeans, Edomians, Gazians, and Azotians. Now, he's breaking up portions of southern Judah into different regions. And that they are partly farmers as the Syrians and Kol Assyrians, and partly merchants as the Phoenicians. So we could see that from Strabo's outside viewpoint, because he's really a stranger to the Judeans, he really doesn't know the history of it that well. He's a Greek and really wouldn't care about it as much. Strabo would know as much about Judean history as the average American would know about Canadian history, right? The internals of it are just a mystery to us because we don't follow it. So later on, he wrote that as for Judea, its western extremities toward Cassius are occupied by the Edomians and by the lake. That lake is the Lake Sirbanus. It was actually a big marshy region that they called a lake that was by the border of Egypt between Gaza and Egypt. Edomians are Abatahians, but owing to a sedition, they were banished from there, joined the Judeans, and shared in the same customs with them. That's his outside viewpoint. He, as an outsider, understood that the Edomites and the Judahites were all mixed up in Judea. And that supports all the history that Flavius Josephus gave about the Maccabees conquering these Edomites and forcing them to convert to Judaism.
In the mouth Strabo of
doesn't know the internal tales, but he knows that it happened.
So Yahweh's following his law, he gave us 2 and 3 witnesses. 3 if we include Paul of Tarsus in Romans 9.
But isn't this partially...
I don't see how. Go ahead.
Isn't this partially witnessed in Nehemiah and Ezra, Nehemiah chapter 7?
Well, it's not Edomites there, and that took place quite a time before.
Okay, sorry.
But it's that sort of apostasy led to the acceptance of this a long time later.
Yeah,
it's horrible type of attitude.
It's very remnant.
It's definitely the same trend.
Yeah, the children of Habiah and children of Kaz and Barzillia and whatever.
Yes, it's definitely the same trend and the same inclination. And it's I can't prove this, right? But I've always felt that it's true. If you read Josephus, book 13, Flavius Josephus, Antiquities of the Judeans, book 13, if you read that, you'll find that right around where he's describing this situation of Hyrcanus going out and conquering these Edomites and converting them, that's when he first mentions the parties of the Sadducees and Pharisees, that they first appeared in Judean history. And that word Pharisee actually means separatist. And it seems to me that the Pharisees, having that name, must have resisted this Edomite absorption at the first. But then they became Republicans. And they didn't care anymore. My theory is that that's how the Pharisees took that name as a party. Because it means separatist.
Yeah, and it shows why some of them are quite better. I know that several of them were actually white, and that's demonstrable in Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus. But also, not just that, but just the fact that some of the people in the Pharisees, they actually care about the law. They actually strive to follow Yahweh if they can find a way to do so. The Sadducees rejected Yahweh. They rejected the Spirit. They rejected the resurrection. They were basically atheists. But at least a lot of the Pharisees tried. Some of them tried.
Right. If you wanted any political influence, if you wanted any role in the polity of the nation, in its function, any say in its governance, right? If you wanted any influence at all, you had to be a Pharisee or a Sadducee. And there were two other parties in Judea. There were the Essenes, and then there was the sect that Josephus mentions of Judas the Galilean, who was a tax protester against the Romans, and they were virulently anti-Roman. But the Essenes and the sect of Judas the Galilean, they were all political outcasts. They had no say in the politics of the nation. And even though the Essenes were more peaceful than the followers of Judas the Galilean, who were very violent, they were like outlaws. The Essenes, Josephus described as the only sect in Judea whose members had to be Judah by birth, meaning they couldn't be Edomites. They had to be pure Judahites, pure Israelites by birth, or they wouldn't be accepted in the Essenes. But they had, so they were racial separatists, but they had no political authority. They had no political influence at all. They were outcasts.
They were the Nazi party. And they had like 20 members.
Right. And the followers of Judas of the Galilean were the Antifa thugs.
Well, could it be speculative?
They were. They were the ones that dressed up like women and went robbing people. They were trannies that robbed people. They were Antifa thugs. I ain't making it up.
Oh, I thought the people who did that were those bandits which are mentioned in Acts.
Yeah, and they were leaked. They were linked by Josephus in a couple of places to the followers of Judas the Galilean, right?
Oh yeah, yeah.
And his sons.
Well, could it be speculated that it became vogue in the time of the Sadducees, especially as we're going to see soon enough in Malachi, to have quote unquote dung spread on their faces?
And yeah, well, that's part of the process, right?
And even to nowadays times, I'm not going to get graphic, but I'll leave it at that.
It's also punishment from God too, in a way. Like in Romans 1, we see Yahweh punishing men by turning them to licentiousness, giving them, how does Paul word it? Bill, do you remember? How does Paul word that?
Gave them over a reprobate mind?
Reprobate mind, yeah. He gives them a reprobate mind. So we see that in Romans 1. And then in Malachi 2, because these priests aren't repenting from their sin, the consequence of this is that they're going to continue in their sin and have bastards. So it's like punishment from God in that sense, because he's letting the consequences of your sin take you over. So he's punishing you in that sense.
Well, just like it's exemplified in many places, but in Revelation, specifically, I think that he uses our faults as punishments against us, just like he uses the non-Adamic races against us right. And then when their time is done, or our time is done, then he punishes them. But we're punished by our own means, right? And that defines that reprobate mind. And it isn't a cause for blame towards God, don't get me wrong, but it just makes perfect sense. If that's what you're going to do, that's what you're going to get.
And I think that's what Paul was referring to, and Paul likely had Solomon in mind. Solomon says that explicitly in his wisdom. A man is punished by his own sin. The consequences of your sin are your punishment.
Absolutely.
So yeah.
The consequences of what's going on here in Malachi and what happened in Judea in the history of Judea and the mixing of Judah with the Edomites that we see in the first century BC and the late second century BC, the consequences of that are found in John chapter 8. And we'll talk about John chapter 8 when we discuss Malachi chapter 2, perhaps. And in Romans chapter 9, Paul's saying that he's praying for his brethren, his kinsmen in regards to the flesh, his kinsmen according to the flesh, those who are Israelites to whom belong the promises and the covenants. And then he's saying that not all of Israel are of Israel. And then he goes on to compare Jacob and Esau, and that's why there's a steady theme from Malachi through the Maccabees and Josephus and into Paul of Tarsus that we could understand very clearly the reasons for the division in the New Testament period were because half these people were Edomites. And when Herod the Edomite became king, he killed all the Hasmoneans, he killed all the Maccabees, and he appointed all of his own people into the powers of authority in the priesthood.
And the process
go
ahead, Bill.
This history is undeniable, and that's the reason for the division in the New Testament. When you see just put those several writers together and what they said, the history can't be denied that this happened.
The corruption of your seed is a punishment.
Yes.
And Herod, he tried to destroy the genetic records and all too.
This undeniable
I don't
history.
That very often. I've read Eusebius also. I have him here on a shelf, but I don't quote that very often because it's so much later. Eusebius didn't write until about 325. Why am I getting feedback? Eusebius didn't write until about 325 AD.
I think this undeniable history, which we're talking about here, this history, I think Paul, he summed it up pretty succinctly when he said, if apostasy had not come first, that's really what led to all this happening. And that apostasy revealed these men of lawlessness.
Yahweh can't be mocked. Also, what we sow, so shall we reap. And that's what's happened.
Sure.
I'm sorry. I'm trying to talk while I'm muted.
If Yahweh had to punish. I'm sorry.
Wow.
It might be my internet or something. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, there seems to be a delay. Maybe it's me. The apostasy is not the Edomite absorption. It's not. The word apostasy, it comes from two Greek words, apo.
No, I was saying wrong. The apostasy led to right. It, though. The apostasy caused it to happen. Because Paul says.
Led to the Edomite absorption.
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because Paul says if it had not come first, so it came first.
Yes.
Yeah. Maybe I worded myself wrong.
Well, it kind of kept coming, and that's what Eric pointed out. It was there in the reign of Nehemiah, and it was straightened out. And then it was back when Ezra was the governor. It was straightened out, but it was always temporary.
Yeah, like there wasn't much time between Nehemiah and Ezra, really.
And Malachi doesn't seem, there wasn't. There was 40 years between them, maybe. No, about 32 years between them. Nehemiah went back to Persia in 490 BC, and Ezra came from the king with his commission about 458 BC. So it's about 32 years, right? But Malachi is powerless to do anything about it. He's only a prophet who is chastising the nation. But he's writing this oracle against them, but he has no political power. So it seems like there's nobody to stop it at this point.
I'm sure they killed
him. There isn't another Ezra or another Nehemiah.
Hey, can I toss in a little tidbit? I don't think it's worthy of like a reference necessarily, but I think on the other side of the spectrum, it's worth saying that when he says return unto me, keeping his commandments and keeping your line clean, I think that runs true through all these references that we're talking about as well.
Well, the line of Malachi is racial from beginning to end. Like, it's racial here in chapter 1. It's racial in chapter 2. It's even racial in chapter 3 with the prophecies of John the Baptist, because that's a restoration of the sons of Levi. And it's racial in chapter 4 with the Elijah ministries and the racial awakening. So it's there's a lot of strong racial themes in this entire book.
Well, it is basically the identity prophecy. It's a prophecy of John the Baptist, Ezra, Elijah. It's the prophecy of the Elijah message.
Yeah. I mean, the whole Bible is racial, but Malachi, it's like the main theme.
Yeah. Yeah, I know Fink was saying, like he said, it's kind of hard to date, but I think it kind of fits as the last book of the Old Testament. I'm not going to try to get romantic on that. It's kind of like a culmination. I'll just leave it at that.
Well, I've thought about that too. It also foreshadows the New Testament. It's showing this process. It's giving a foreshadowing of that process of the conditions which we see later manifest in the time of Christ.
Absolutely.
So it's a very fitting final book. Another thing we see here is a prophecy of identity theft, at least in my opinion, because Yahweh is addressing Edom and speaking of what they're doing. And then he speaks of this nation they're going to make in the far future, which is a border of wickedness and the people whom Yahweh has indignation against forever. And then Yahweh calls that nation, which he hates, which the Edomites are going to make, Israel. Yahweh will be magnified from the border of Israel. So this is also a prophecy of identity theft.
Yes, let's talk about that a moment. I'll talk about that a moment, if you don't mind.
Yeah,
this is somewhere around 500 BC. I'm sorry, 400 BC, the end of the 5th century BC, maybe the beginning of the 4th, right? So maybe it's 370 BC. It can't be much later than that. But okay, the temple's been rebuilt. The walls have been rebuilt. The city's been rebuilt. Ezra was sent to rebuild the city to finish the building. And we can only imagine that everything's built by this time, because when Alexander comes in 330 BC, he's coming to a whole city, right? A complete city that's been there a while in the historical context of his coming to Jerusalem. So Jerusalem wasn't destroyed because they cooperated with Alexander. That they, according to Josephus, they even showed Alexander how he fulfilled certain prophecy in the book of Daniel. So by Malachi's time, this must be a whole city. It's not a desolate place. From what we've seen in the time of the Maccabees, it's a thriving place. It's not desolate at all. So they're still under Persian rule. They're not under Greek rule yet. Everything's rebuilt, and there are no desolate places. Where are these desolate places that Esau is going to rebuild? But we will return. We are impoverished, but we will return and build the desolate places. Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, they shall build, but I will throw down, and they shall call them the border of wickedness. Well, there's absolutely no records of the ancient original lands of Edomia having been rebuilt. And there's nothing rebuilt, or there's nothing desolate in all of Palestine at this time. It's thriving at this time. In fact, in the Persian War against the Greeks in the failed invasion, not long before the time of Malachi, the Phoenicians actually helped the Persians build like 2,500 ships to invade Greece. And they lost all those ships to the Greeks, but they still built that many ships for the Greeks. So this is a thriving area at this time. Nothing desolate. There's nothing desolate in Judea until Christ tells the Pharisees, his enemies, your house will be left to you desolate. And the Romans created a desolation in Judea. That's when the desolation finally occurred. That's the only desolation this could be talking about. And nothing was rebuilt again that was of note and associated with Jews until 1948. That's when the Jews, that's when Edom returned to rebuild the desolate places. It was in 1948.
Well, that's only their intention, Bill, because they are a desolation, aren't they?
Well, yes, they are. They've been rebuilding that area, and we can wait for it to be thrown down. So, in other words, there is no short vision fulfillment of this. The desolate places are already rebuilt. That Jerusalem's already rebuilt when Malachi's writing this.
We pray for this racial awakening where our people will finally say, it's that, you know, Yahweh has hated Edomites forever. The people against whom Yahweh has indignation forever. That's racial awakening right there.
Now, these verses, yes, it's absolutely a racial awakening, yes. But these verses at the end of this chapter about offering the blind for sacrifice, is it not evil? And the lame and the sick for sacrifice, is it not evil? There are specific laws in Deuteronomy and Leviticus that the animals offered for sacrifice had to be whole. They had to be without blemish. Sin offerings had to be without blemish so that you couldn't, like, pick the lame animal out of your flock and sacrifice that one. You had to take a healthy animal to the priest. So this is telling us that they're taking their faith for granted, and they're only worshiping Yahweh superficially in the Second Temple period. They're not the taking priest, that their faith seriously at all.
The priest also had to be without blemish, Bill. Couldn't be a mongrel. Couldn't be some kike. That can't be a priest. So they're also polluting the sacrifices by having mongrels offer sacrifices to Yahweh. He doesn't want that.
Yeah, it's a type.
Right.
Also.
But yeah. It's also this fault. I mean, if you're the priest and you're collecting my sacrifice and I bring you a three-legged steer and you take it, then you have just as much fault as I do.
I love this argument which Yahweh uses. He says that they would never do that for their governor. So they fear their governor more than they fear God.
Just like the Jews at the time, they hated, they said, we have no king but Caesar. Because they hate right. Yahweh.
It's also the prevalent attitude in society today. People fear the government, they don't fear God. So that's sort of been a problem all through time.
Something I like about sacrifice, like how that worked in the Old Testament period, is that you are also showing your trust in God because you're giving up the best of your flock. You're showing trust that he was going to provide for you.
Right.
It's also brotherly love, Abel, because the priest ends up eating the sacrifice. So they didn't realize at that time that it was all brotherly love. They forgot that part.
Well, that's true, Joe. Yeah. That's a good point.
Well, I don't mean to diminish what you guys were saying with a childish example, but it probably taught you at a young age, like, oh yeah, don't get too attached to that nice little lamb or goat, because if you do wrong, it's gonna get sacrificed.
Yeah, that would be good encouragement for children, maybe.
That's what I meant. Sorry.
Yeah. But hey, I mean, even as a man, you can get a bond with an animal. I'm thinking more dogs, but I'm sure people have had bonds with their sheep.
Well, that, but also, I guess, as far as even men and women, you know, if you saw that sacrifice go on, if someone were stoned to death, that example would last generations.
Yeah.
Did you have something to say, Bill?
No, I'm good.
I just wanted to add, these Jews also hated the priesthood, the true priesthood. So they wouldn't have had any, they hate Yahweh, they hate the true priesthood, they're offering polluted sacrifices, so then the true priests have nothing. They're trying to replace the true priest. And we find out, you know, in other places in the Bible, that some of the Levites had left the priesthood because they had nothing and they couldn't continue in the priesthood.
And they were babies.
It's like these Jews, the mongrels hate the true priesthood. They're pushing them out. The true priesthood can't live because there's no brotherly love anymore. They're getting tainted sacrifices or no sacrifices. So it's all this is happening because these mongrels are squeezed their way in, like the tares are in the field of the wheat.
It's actually explained in Josephus that the Sadducees used to send out the Sadducees, who were the high priests in the first century at the time of Christ, used to send out their henchmen into the communities and take the tithes from the Levites. They would rob the Levites of their tithes. They operated like a crime ring. The same way the same Edomite Jews operated the papacy in the time of the Borgias, the Medicis, and Della Roveries. They were acting like crime families that were trying to kill each other and engaging in all sorts of nepotism and trying to outdo each other in rivalries and shady dealing.
And it's that's like a mafia crime drama.
Created our society now, it's mostly nepotism. Regardless if you're in the public or private sector, for the most part, if you have a good job, it's usually due to nepotism. You know, I was looking at verse 14, the deceiver. It's Strong's 5230, and it has Nakal, which I think you, I'm not sure if it's the same word that you mentioned before that you think is nigger is derived from, or stranger, right? It's stranger.
No, oh, that's Nakar.
Nakar, okay.
It's Nakar.
But here you have just... go on.
I don't know if there's an etymological link. I would have to look at them closely in a whole group of words, right?
Yeah, because I'm looking at the Strong's. It's like someone who conspires, deceives, deals subtly, plots, deals craftily, swindler.
Nekar, nigger.
Yeah, like I mean, that's what it seems like to me, a deceiver, right? But in any case.
Yeah, even though Nekar had, that Nekar word had some innocuous uses, right? Just of one Israelite who really didn't know another sometimes. It still means stranger, and an alien is a Nakar, and I swear that must be the word that Niger, the Latin word for black, eventually evolved from.
Yeah.
Or that word eventually evolved into the word for nigger.
Yeah, which just means black, right? Basically, in Latin, it means black. Negro.
Yes, Niger basically means black in Latin.
I thought that's where we get the word from.
Okay, so one other thing, go on, Bill.
In the Roman world, in the early Roman world, when everybody was a Roman and there really weren't a whole lot of quote unquote strangers within the Roman world, the niggers would have been the strangest thing that you could find. That you could see.
Yeah, for sure. I don't think
they're
my parents
alienated.
I don't think my parents saw a nigger till they got to Canada, and they were like in their mid 20s. I don't think they ever saw a nigger in person. I gotta ask them one day. Because there were no niggers in Eastern Europe. I mean,
and you gotta remember, like, a nigger is a stranger to God too. So it's like the strangest thing that could possibly be.
35. Okay, so this is not really relative or relevant, but you mentioned the Marisha earlier, like 15 minutes ago, that river in Judah. So there's just an extra proof that the Israelites came to Europe. There's a river in it runs from Bulgaria to Turkey, and it starts in the mountains of Bulgaria and it runs southeast and eventually into the Aegean Sea, and it separates Greece from Turkey, and it's called the Maritsa.
Okay. It's a town in Judah here, but that's okay.
Wasn't it a river though?
I don't think so.
There wasn't a Marisha River?
Sorry, I don't think so.
In Judah? Okay. It used to be called Hebros. Before it was called Maritsa in, I guess, in Europe, it was called Hebros, which reminds me of Hebrew, right? By the Greeks, but I don't know. Maybe I'm stretching.
So I was having a bit of internet trouble before.
Pardon me? What was that, Joe?
I was having a bit of internet trouble, so I didn't know. I don't know if you guys discussed verse 10, where it says, "Who is there who even among you that would shut the doors for naught?" Well, in Revelation 7, I think it is, it says that Christ is the one who opens and no man shutteth, and the one who shutteth and no man opens. So I'm just thinking, you know, that's a good cross-reference for this verse here. Malachi 1:10 is the verse in Revelation where Christ speaks that he's the one who opens. He's the one who shutteth.
1:10 you said, Joe, or 2:10? 1:10?
Malachi 1:10. Oh, you guys on 2:10
now. No. That's what I thought you said. No, we haven't gotten to 2 yet. I'm sorry. That's what I was going to say.
Oh, okay. Yeah, 1:10. You see, here, Eric Cart says, "Who is there even among you that would shut the doors for naught?"
Right, and where does sin lieth? But I was going to say also, maybe it's not a good reference, but just in the last one I was going to give earlier was, I was wondering if it may be, I mean, it's not just one or two parts of Revelation, but maybe 19:2, because his judgments are righteous and true, since he has judged the great whore who has ruined the earth with her fornication. I wanted to throw that in there with just where we were at, where we left off, as a possible reference, maybe, or just a representation of how history repeats.
I actually meant Revelation 3:7, where it says,
"He adding
that is true, he that hath the key of David, he that openeth and no man shutteth, and shutteth and no man openeth."
No, I'm sorry, Joe. I heard what you said. I was where we left off. I was at. That's the last thing I was going to add that might have maybe been exemplified by where we left off that I didn't say before. But that's it. That was something separate.
In my commentary on Malachi, I'd made that connection, Joe, and I said that the door represents access to God. The separation of the inner chamber of the temple into which the high priest went once a year to make propitiation for sin, with the presence of Yahweh descending upon the mercy seat. Paul explained this in his epistle to the Hebrews, where he also states that such propitiation is found only in Christ, Hebrews chapters 9 and 10. This is the door spoken of here in Malachi. That was my contention in my Malachi commentary. It is the door of that message to the Assembly of Philadelphia in Revelation as well. And that's this, that message happens to be the Church of Brotherly Love, right?
This is unrelated.
I don't want to kill the conversation.
This is unrelated, but in Malachi 2, we see Yahweh lamenting that they're taking strange wives, and he tells them to seek a godly seed and to seek a wife of the covenant. And when you refuse to marry a woman of your own race, you're effectively shutting up the door of her womb too. It's a bit unrelated, but it's right. Something I thought of.
Well, that's why I referenced Revelation 19, but should we just get on to the next chapter then? Joe isn't being silent. He's having internet troubles. He dropped.
It's getting kind of late to start another chapter.
There's a lot to say in Malachi 2.
I know.
There's a lot to talk about.
We've already gone like halfway
through. I don't want to rush you.
No, that's fair.
We're not going to rush it.
We've already discussed like half of it, but no, that's fair. I'm just
we haven't even scratched the surface on chapter 2.
Okay, I'm sorry. No, I don't.
Doubles face a lot of chapters that are salient in relation to chapter 1 that are valid points, right? That because it's, the chapter divisions just suck, right? So perhaps there shouldn't be chapters and verses in the Bible. Shouldn't be.
You make that very apparent. Yeah, maybe we should just finish chapter 1 then. I'm sorry. I'm not trying to lead us anywhere we shouldn't.
Unless we have more to discuss in chapter 1. I mean, there's a lot here. It's very meaty, right? Malachi is very meaty.
Yeah.
Let me ask a question. I'd understood and I'd heard it before that the key of David was understanding the bloodlines. Would that fit?
Was the key of David understanding the bloodlines? I think that might be somebody's conjecture.
I just heard that, Bill. Knowing the bloodlines, I guess.
The key of David is only mentioned two places. In Revelation chapter 3, verse 7, Christ says that he's the one who has the key of David. He opens and no man shuts, and shuts and no man opens. In other words, only Christ determines whether or not you enter the kingdom of heaven, period.
Okay.
The first time it's mentioned is in Isaiah chapter 22, verse 22. And it's in the prophecy of a faithful servant, Eliakim, which means God raises, the son of, which means my portion is Yahweh. And I will clothe him with thy robe and strengthen him with thy girdle, and I will commit thy government in his hand. God raises. I can. I'm sorry, this is a short-term fulfillment. It's a prophecy of Christ, in my opinion. I will commit my government into thy government, into his hand, and he shall be a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah, which is what a political leader is seen as, right? Even though it's not really right, it's how the people see a political leader or a strong king as a father. And the key of the house of David will I lay upon his shoulder. So he shall open, shall shut, and he shall shut, and none shall open. And I will nail him, as fasten him as a nail in a sure place, and he shall be for a glorious throne to his father's house. But then there's a point prophesied right after that there's a point that comes that in that day shall the nail that is fastened in the sure place be removed, and shall be cut down and fall. And the burden that was upon it shall be cut off, for Yahweh has spoken it. So I believe that happened in the destruction of Jerusalem, when the throne of David in Palestine was not, and it returned to Christ, that Christ is the legitimate king in Israel now, and only Christ. Even though the prophecy didn't fail, that sons of Judah and the house of David have had seats as kings in Europe for centuries,
that the true king is Christ, period.
Yeah, and despite the time of Samuel, we see Yahweh identify himself as king right here in chapter 1. For I am a great king, saith Yahweh of hosts.
But otherwise, Kevin, that king of that key of David prophecy is quite ambiguous, because no key of David was ever mentioned in the historical books of scripture.
Makes sense.
The key of the house of David gives people the right to enter the house. Just like the tabernacles of David will be raised. I think David's kingdom is, in those prophecies, is used for a model or a type of the ideal kingdom, which is the kingdom of heaven. That's my opinion.
Okay.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, you mentioned that in your Revelation series. I was actually listening to it.
In Amos 9:11, there's kind of a parallel prophecy. In that day, I will raise up the tabernacle of David that has fallen. Amos chapter 9. And that is recognized as a prophecy of Christ in Acts chapter 15, in verse 16. After this, I will return and will build again the tabernacle of David.
Yeah, and actually, you cited that. Cited that in your Revelation series.
Probably.
Well, if I can quantify why I mentioned chapter 19 of the Revelation, as far as ruining the earth with her fornication, was referencing chapter 18, where she says that she's a queen, she is no widow, she's rich, or something like that. And that's where I saw some something being exemplified throughout history, like we were talking about over and over, like in 110, Malachi 110, or otherwise. What about Esau? They mix themselves and don't care about themselves. Sorry, that was the last thing I wanted to say on the chapter.
It seems to me where they say, what about Esau? You know, that could be an excuse as well, because they're trying to justify why they have Edomites in the priesthood. And they're like, well, wasn't Esau Jacob's brother? You know, he's part of it.
Yeah,
and sometimes I think that.
That could be the near vision here. There has to be a context in the near vision, too.
I think that was kind of my angle on that.
Well, what we were talking about at the time was we keep ruining ourselves with fornication by transgression, and then God punishes us by the transgression. So that was my whole point.
If we didn't follow Yahweh's law, and to punish us, he had to do something supernatural, and then how does that show his law is good? He shows his law is good because if you don't follow it, you're naturally falling into a pit because his law is good. So it shows his law is good in that sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Good call. I mean, he doesn't have to really lift a finger. He doesn't have to create anything new. He just has to. I mean, we use ourselves against us by our failure.
It's just the natural consequences. Like the further this, west, the West gets from Yahweh's law, the closer it is to falling.
Yeah, good call.
And we're getting pretty far away right now, like, you know, these trannies and all this race mixing and stuff and the adultery that goes on as well. food laws, no one cares about them. You know, if we're eating bugs, that's getting it. You know, people didn't care about Yahweh's food laws. Now they're going to be eating bugs. How much more, you know, how much further away can we get from his laws? And the further we get away, the closer it is to collapse. No society can stand, you know, on sand. You know, on the, we have to, you have to build a society on rock, on God's law.
In Romans,
it won't stand.
Yeah, because otherwise you have nothing.
In Romans 7:12, it says, wherefore the law is holy and the commandment holy and just and good. And when you look at the denominational sects of Christianity, they don't even have any concept or clue of what holiness is.
Yeah.
Nope. No, because most of their laws are based on humanism. They're based on the society, and I guess you could reduce it to pop culture. That's what the Judeo-Christian churches base their beliefs on. They don't base it on scripture.
Well, yeah. Universalism is the antithesis of holiness.
Well, yes.
Definitely. Right, yeah.
Yeah,
and so it makes sense for them. Sorry, go on, Bill.
No, I'm just agreeing. It absolutely is.
Well, isn't
they worship the beast, right? So they're going to take their laws from that. When I say laws, I mean like their opinions, which essentially they project as laws. It's really a sad situation. Everything's upside down, essentially.
Well, isn't that
the base laws?
Pardon? Sorry,
Joe. Well, the base laws are fine. They're nice. But Yahweh's laws are mean.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a really good way to put it, because it's all about feels, right?
Do well, what thou wilt is like the Satanist law.
Biblical love equals worldly hatred, and worldly love equals biblical hatred. These two are opposing from each other.
Yeah.
Well, our failures are exemplary of the repetition of the modernity of the time. Whatever idol is the top idol, whatever is replacing our God-given law and right to do his will at the time, and then we fuck up, and then we repent, and we're awaiting our repentance again.
Well, sorry.
An affliction must come.
Well, we really demonstrate that we hate Yahweh when you think about 1 John 2:15 and 16 and James 4:4 and look at those verses. And, you know, if we love the world, you know, what are we really demonstrating to Yahweh? You know, we can't love Yahweh in the world.
Yeah. We're adulterous.
That we hate him. That's what we're doing.
I have something to say in verse 11, where it says, for from the rising of the sun, even unto the going down of the same, my name shall be great among the nations. And that means from east to west, and that's nations there. And that was accomplished through Christ. And because that was accomplished through Christ, you can see the wordplay here is pretty similar wordplay as we see in the end of Malachi. For from the rising of the sun.
Well, so that's not, I'm not looking at it now, but that's not coming and going. It's east and west. Because,
that's how I'd interpret it. He's saying, you know, from the east to the west, my name shall be great among the nations. But I'm just giving another interpretation, which ties to how Malachi ends in Malachi 4:2.
Yeah, I think that is. That's in the Hebrew, though. That the words used in the Hebrew actually mean what I haven't checked it, but usually that's what it is in the Hebrew.
Well, it's east and west. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah.
And then you bring it to English, and from the rising of the sun, that wordplay only works in English, as Bill has pointed out, because in the Greek and the Hebrew and that, sun and sun don't have that wordplay. Like, the rising of the sun of God. that only works in English. So it's like God foresaw the English language.
Well, because I just was wondering, in that case, I'm not looking at it, but it's either a verb versus a direction, right? If you want to look at it that way.
You guys want me to cut it, or?
Yeah, we can end this, David. That's fine. I'm happy with it.